in Hebrews. Let's go to Hebrews. This morning in the breakfast meeting, we talked about a scripture that's, it's the only time in the Bible where it says to examine yourself. And we're not going to go there right now, but it's the one that says, examine yourself, prove that you're in the faith, know you not that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobate. And then we went through all the scriptures that of what it looks like for Jesus Christ to be your life, for him to be in you, and we found out that none of them are what you think it is going to be. I mean, I am convinced in my own this thing that if Jesus Christ were really here, that there would be nice people in the Bible study, right? And they would be, there wouldn't be any mess. They wouldn't make messes. They'd be well trained. The bathroom would be finished. Why?
You're convinced of this?
Yeah, I am in my mind. If I believe my mind, that there wouldn't be any sickness. That we would have enough money to buy up all the houses around here. That we would, on and on. I'd never have to worry about whether or not there was enough money to meet payroll on Monday mornings. I wouldn't have to worry about if I got enough money in the bank before Delvin came and wanted his check.
Just give him a gallon of coffee and send him away.
What?
Just give him a gallon of coffee and send him away.
Yeah. But that's not what it is. It's the hallmark of the certainty that Christ is in us is that we can glory in tribulation, that we will fail. The hallmarks of a saint are suffering and humility, not success and money. I'm going to do this thing that I haven't done for a long time. The crossfire spot about what would God say to the church in America. Most of you have heard it. If you haven't, just bear with me. What would God say to the church in America? I think he would say, "O evil and perverse generation, have I been so long in your midst and you perceive me not? Have I not met your needs in a thousand ways? When I speak to you, you do not hear. You behave not as sons and daughters, but as strangers. You hold meetings in my name and give honor to men, but not to me. You boast that you serve me, but in truth you serve your own ego. For that which you do is calculated to enhance your own position and advance your own prestige, and you give it all a sanctimonious cloak. See, you say, we shall pray. Oh, prayer is farthest from your hearts. Prayer is for those whose hearts cry unto me in sincerity and who seek me earnestly, not for those with only a pretended piety and with hearts made fat with self-adulation, are only playing with me as a child would manipulate a puppet on a string. Get to the prayer closet. That is the reason I taught you to pray in secret, for there you are beset by fewer false motives and less temptations. He who does not habitually commune with me alone in prayer is almost sure to find true prayer impossible in public. You would make your religion pleasant and acceptable. You would make it comfortable and accommodating to your own schedule. Your Savior knew nothing of such a false religion. Lonely nights he wrestled in prayer. He spared not the flesh discomfort. Yes, the more you pamper your own flesh as to bodily comfort, the more it shall demand of you until your physical needs become a tyrant unto you in your own house. Be not deceived. I gave you no such commandment. Hear me as I repeat to you what I gave to your fathers. Abandon yourself, pick up your cross, and follow me. Yes, follow me, not some worldly form of a backslidden church. Think not that it becometh blessed because it bears the name church. My church is a living body, not a dead form. My people may be recognized by their humility and suffering, not by their social acceptability and self-advertised success, not by extravagant physical appointments of their buildings, but by the grace of God at work in their hearts. Sacrifice is my only status symbol. And man has not been eager to duplicate the spiritual leadership I had in servants like Paul or Jeremiah. Do you desire to follow me truly? Then follow the blood-stained prints of my feet. Go, as it were, to the cold, unyielding rock in the Garden of Gethsemane, where self is put aside and the cup of suffering is accepted. Die to your own treacherous and deceitful heart. Then rise with determination to go on unflinchingly, not hoping to spare your life. Save your life, and you will surely lose it. Off offered up to me this very day, this very second, in a renewal of consecration and a sacrificial living, and I will accept you, and you shall know joy as new wine. Don't get me. We've got to see that faith is of a different dimension than what our minds and what religion has told us it is. Faith is the certainty that all things are today, right now, under His feet, under His control, under His dominion. But we don't see yet all things put under Him. We see something else. What do we see? We see Jesus. It's the certainty wherever you think that there is something that doesn't look like it should, that Jesus is in it, and you can rest in that. Now, shame is the thing that it's like we think that it's the worst possible thing that can happen. We do everything in our universe to avoid exposing the shame because we know from experience that it immobilizes us. We know also from experience here that the only way to be free of shame is to be able to laugh at it. And so that's what... The only way to be free of shame is to be able to laugh at it. To have somebody else bring it up and you not be destroyed by it. You know, it's
probably the function of humor.
It is, I'm sure. Spiritually, the reason that humor exists is so that we can despise the shame. In Hebrews chapter 12, well, let's go and see what faith looks like. Chapter 11. The whole chapter 11 is about faith, but starting in verse 33, chapter 11, verse 33. Who faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. This is the fruit of faith that we're reading about here. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens of caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. They couldn't be complete without us. I can't be complete without you. We can't be complete without the other groups here. But it has to have an identifiable way of, an identifiable thing of where it's tested, where it's made real. And I think, I've been thinking, if you start looking at the word shame and looking in the concordance and its derivatives and the words that are about shame, it is all over the Bible. And the idea, I think, and just from my own experience and what I've seen here, that the reason that we gather in these small groups of 10 to 20 people, that we might eat of the Passover lamb, the fruit of whether or not we truly eat of the Passover lamb is that we will be without shame. That's the final test of whether or not you believe. Do you understand that there's no shame?
Isn't that having all things in common?
You're naked and not ashamed. You've opened your life up and there's no shame. You don't care who told you were naked. Who told you had a need? So anyway. Wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. Now that'll give you pause to think a minute. They're watching you every second.
So what do you think you're going to hide?
Huh?
What do you think you're going to hide that you're ashamed of?
You're in deep trouble, Harry.
Yeah, as I said that.
Wherefore, we are composed about by about so great a cloud of witnesses. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith, who, instead of the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, that seems like it's pretty, that elevates in the same sentence shame, the act of despising the shame, with faith, with the resurrection, with being seated at the right hand of God. So we better find out what despising the shame means. Is there anybody is there anybody here that can't be here Thursday night? Shame makes us acutely aware of ourselves, painfully aware of ourselves. It makes us, we are convinced that there's nowhere to hide. We stand exposed, bound, immobilized. Whenever we're confronted with the shame. We don't have tablets, do we? We can't make a list tonight, can we?
We have paper.
You have to use a whole tablet.
Husband needs paper.
Like a dinner.
You all have to use an entire book.
Well, I'm sure you do if you're right, if you're honest. Especially, you'd have to use three. Well, let's go to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 25. Well, let's go up. Let's go up to 18. The preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Now, it's imperative here that you recognize something that we touched on last spring or last year, but I don't think it touched our psyche. And that is that the word cross, at the time this was written, this is saying that the preaching of the cross is the power of God. Now, the cross is a word that at that time, it was a word of shame. It was a death that was reserved for the lowlife. It was not a death that was honorable. It was a death that was reserved for the low. First of all, in America, we don't even recognize that the cross means death. People run around with, how many people have crosses around their necks tonight? I'm glad. How many people have little electric chairs around their neck?
Little heavy chairs.
The cross was the form of death. And first of all, therefore, we have to recognize if we're going to study the cross, we're talking about death. It's not something you're going to get something from. But it's not just death. It's not some heroic death. The cross was reserved for the worst form of criminal. It was reserved for the ones that were guilty of betrayal, of child abuse, child rape, child murder. It was the crime of sedition. It was these slimy crimes that even the criminals recognize are slimy, that if you are in a prison hierarchy, if all of the people that are in a prison, and there's a massive social structure in prison, the ones that were at the very lowest are the ones that are, the lowest of the low are the homosexual men that have sexual, the non-consensual, consental relationships with small boys. In a prison, that is as low as it gets. The next level would be any kind of child abuse. The next level would be those that had betrayed people, because in a, that's the basis of any society has to be trust. So if you betray the trust, then you're, they don't trust you in any society. So that's the people for whom the cross was reserved. You understand that? So when it's, the scriptures talk about the preaching of the cross is the power of God, and your identification with the cross, we're at a different level than it's being taught in America today. We're at a different level. It doesn't mean what doesn't mean what's being said. It means that we must identify with the lowest of the low. There's no glory connected to the flesh with regard to the cross. Does everybody understand that?
Yeah. Used to be we could watch TV, you know, watch the news, and they'd be talking about somebody that, like, poisoned his wife or shot this person or whatever. You could still afford yourself some, like, well, I haven't done that or whatever, but it's like now, not so sure.
Well, let's 1 Corinthians, let's go on. I'm going to read, and then we're going to talk in specific about a couple things. But for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, chapter 1, verse 18. But unto us which are saved, and the word there, but for those ex-Baptists among us, the word is in the tense that says, for those who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? You know what the word prudent means in the Greek? Here? It's the one that has the ability to add 1 + 1 and get 2. That's prudent. Why? Why does he destroy the wisdom of the prudent and the wisdom of the wise? Because if prudence was the answer, then cause and effect would be the answer. So he has to destroy the wisdom of the prudent and the wisdom of the wise, so there can be no cause and effect, no appearance of cause and effect. The highest degree that wisdom can take you, the highest that education can get you, the highest that intelligence can bring you, is to say that your sin is as scarlet. Now, still we're not dealing with shame here. Shame is like, this is just, these are all, shame isn't an individual act. Shame brings with it, in order for it to be, individual acts are guilt. What shame is the sense of that you have totally disappointed and betrayed someone to the depth of your being, to even question your worthiness.
And it's not just the individual, it's the family, the tribe.
Yeah.
It brings shame on everybody connected.
Right. Where's the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer of this world? Hath not God made the foolishness, made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. That's a silly, for Baptists, that's a silly sentence construction. Where's the Baptist when we need him? By the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. In other words, they already believe. You understand? You don't understand that, but it's an interest. If you're a Baptist, you'll understand it better. By the foolishness of preaching to save them that already believe. In other words, it's a process. For the Jews require a sign, the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now this is where we want to go. For you see your calling, brethren. Now this is, the calling means the ones that are you're around, the ones that you're with. You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, And the base things, now the word base here, it's a word that's here in this century, in this culture, everything was family lineage still. I mean, if you were you were of the noblesse oblige, it was the noble blood, the noble obligation. It was, and the rest were the peasants or the untouchables, like now in India. The word base here refers to that which is the lowest of the low in the perception of the people. Well, last night Tara and I watched a portion of the Channel 13 special on Martin Luther King that they run every year. And the point that it was as clear to me as a bell, his power was based on this.
This is driving me nuts, so I gotta say it and get mocked, but... Martin Luther knew this, right? I mean, Martin Luther knew this, he understood this, right? I went to a Lutheran university. I took 21 hours of religion. I went to chapel 3 to 5 times a week for 4 years. I studied with guys, that had spent their whole lives studying Luther and teaching Luther. I feel sort of pissed off.
What Luther?
Martin Luther.
Martin Luther, the founder.
How do they have a relation to Martin Luther?
I'm not responding to the comment about Martin Luther King. I'm responding to this.
The Martin Luther.
It's the same thing. But, I don't know. It's just...
Well, in every generation, it's the rarest thing there is to know this stuff. I mean, everybody knows it, but nobody pays any attention to it.
Harry and I were listening to, we're doing these tapes. We're listening to you talk on some talk show, and Harry just looks at me, just look at each other and go, he's nuts!
Yeah, we really
he's
do.
He's out of hand!
He's out there. This guy is, he's nuts!
This is on the radio!
This was live!
It was so funny.
He did this live!
What was it? What was it this about?
Well, it was... I mean, the same stuff. It's just like stuff.
You did that cross-fire spot.
This is the preaching of the cross is like, it cuts through everything. I mean, there's nothing, nothing can stand in the way of it. I mean, there's nothing.
You can't say, oh yeah, that.
Oh yeah, right.
Okay, and the base things of the world and the things which are despised has God chosen. Yea, the things which are not to bring to naught those things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Now, God has chosen the things which are despised. For those of you who haven't done it, you ought to come to the morning breakfast meetings just once. I mean, it's like a joy to behold.
Talking about base.
Huh? Are there more felons per capita?
Ragged, man.
Again, there are more felons per capita than there are in Huntsville. Okay, this is a good scripture for that, but he's chosen the base things of the world, the things which are despised. Now, you've got to understand this. You have to identify with what has been despised in you. Don't externalize this. It's only in your weakness that his power is going to be revealed. Now, I don't like that. I hate that. If I were God, I would change it. I hate it.
I hate that.
I mean, the fact that God is identifying and using, and I have to become one with the things about me that I hate, just drives me insane. I hate weakness above all things. And yet I have become so totally weak, it's unbelievable. I mean, half the time somebody has to almost carry me. You must identify with the weakness in you. You must embrace that weakness. not try to rebuild to meet some standards of behavior that you have had in the past or that your world says you should have. It's really important. This is where the power of God is. And brethren, that no flesh should glory in his presence, but of him are you in Christ Jesus, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. That according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you, save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. Now, that's the thing that I want us to concentrate on a minute. That I was with you, that I am determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And remember that we've talked about the cross and crucified are the same, the same thing, the same genre, from the same milieu.
Oh my God.
It's a real tour de force.
Oh, God.
Psychologists define shame as a sense, and it's an overpowering sense, that we have radically disappointed others, that we have radically failed to meet some standard of acceptability. So again, guilt is internal. Guilt is a whole other story. Shame has to do with it's the second of the Ten Commandments, that we have radically disappointed another, and it usually has come in our lives at a time before we develop the capacity to justify ourselves or to rationalize. You understand what I'm saying? So it came at a relatively, most of the shame-based reality or things that drive you came before you could really think about it. Now, okay, the whole idea of what we want to end up with is transparency. The idea that we want to become to a place where we are naked but not ashamed, where we are, you know, the cliche that we use around here sometimes is that where someone knows everything there is to know about you and likes you anyway. That's sort of like the test. Now, I want to concentrate tonight. We'll take a 5-minute break. But what I want to concentrate on tonight is, what did Jesus Christ do with shame? How did he deal with shame? If he took on all of everything about us, how did he take on shame? I forgot to talk about it in here. I mentioned it somewhere, but on the 20th, on the 17th of January, which is just a few days ago, it was 20 years since I became a believer, and it just blows my mind when I think that. It was a specific point in time. January 17th, 1972, and it just, the world exploded. And, it's like one of the things that I now remember that I saw, but I didn't know what it meant, was community, was people, was the idea that there was no separation between life and your spiritual. I mean, there was no... And I remember that what I was just overwhelmed with was the difficulty of the last 20 years. I mean, the mind-blowing. For those, some of you don't know, I was homeless for a significant amount of time, living on the street. Had no money, no food whatsoever. And I couldn't... I mean, it was total. It was like, once the thing happened, I couldn't ever again lean on my own talents to try to figure something out or to try to get something in the name of God. I tried for a while, but fortunately God destroyed that. And this thing that basically, I've never made a decision for the 20 years. If there was a choice of things to do, I did nothing. And that's a great filter in your life. If you're ever confronted with choices, you do nothing. And that's the way that the guidance of God works. It's the cloud in the wilderness. And it so simplifies your life. You know, because you've always, the mind is never going to stop. It's a swarm of bees. And, you know, you start falling in love with ideas, don't we? Yeah. And then you start worshiping those ideas, and they're just gods that you've created. Pretty soon there's no life. There's nothing except the sparks that you generate yourself. And there's nothing more boring than the sparks you generate yourself. But it's, you know, I can assure you, if you're a new believer, or relatively, that during the course of the 20 years, that you know, I have failed constantly, but He has never failed. He has never forsaken me. No matter how many times I tried to run away, no matter how many mistakes I made, no matter how many but you've got to be willing tonight for it to cost you your life. Everything about you has to die. You can't keep the good stuff or what you think is good. We are about something totally different than what it looks like. Let me see now. Since I've been a believer, I've been electrocuted. There was two contracts from the mafia out on me. I was chased all over Europe and the Middle East. I was held hostage, put in jail in Syria, urinated on by the guards. Spent a whole lot of time hungry. I wouldn't change it for the world. Met Tyra.
Lost 9 million.
No, that was before. And it wasn't 9 million. Anyway, the cross. Shame. Let's go to Mark 15.
They're really the same.
The cross was a word in staros. It's in Greek, it's the word staros. And in, I can't remember what it was in Latin, but it's something like. What the first century dreaded most about the cross wasn't the death, it was the shame. And it's so hard for us to understand that, because there's nothing in our society that does it, so we don't have anything to compare it to. It was deliberate, public. It heightened the disgrace. The word staros in the Greek and whatever the Latin one is, you didn't say in polite society. It was worse than fuck. I mean, it was a word that you couldn't say in a polite group of people because it was so disgraceful. It was the disgrace of the cross, not the death. Now, that's what we're about.
Yeah, it would be illegal now. It's like being tortured to death. Publicly tortured to death.
cruel than you.
Television for the electric chair.
Oh, much worse than the electric chair.
The specific formula for sentencing was the following. The judge would proclaim, "Executioner, bind his hands, veil his head, and hang him on the tree of shame." Now, many times, the people were killed before they were crucified. And they were... The reason was is like in the cases that are written in the literature is where a Roman soldier disgraced his unit by cowardice, and he was then, even though he was dead, he was crucified so that it would publicly disgrace his family. You understand? In some offenses, if you know, like, that's why they weren't too worried about whether or not they, you know, 40 stripes is what was the death penalty. 39 was what they gave Jesus. And so, if he would have died on the 39th stripe, which happened a lot, they wouldn't have mattered because he would have still been crucified. So it was the shame of the crucifixion, it was the shame of the cross that was so terrible. Even after death, they were liable to the shaming of their names and their families. I mean, it's just—it's like I can't. I wish there was something that we could compare it to in our society. Anyway. Let's go to Mark 15. Do you remember when we studied this last spring, many of you? Here's what, you know, like in stealth, we studied the meaning of all of the offerings in 87. They didn't remember that we'd ever even studied them. I mean, it's because there's a thing that takes place in the bodies that your mind literally, it's a corporate thing. I mean, there's a time for it, and for those of you that don't remember, we studied most of this stuff last year, but I get the sense that nobody remembers that we studied it.
I remember it.
You weren't here.
I remember studying it somewhat very distinctly. I guess,
yeah, you had all the shame tapes.
Yeah, I remember studying it.
Aren't you ashamed?
All right. And straight away in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. Now, if the truth were known, they wouldn't have had to bind him physically because the shame of it would have bound him. Here we have the Son of God, the Prince of Peace, the King of Kings, being condemned to the most shameful process that was possible to happen. It's analogous to his birth. Everybody loves, you know, we've talked about it here so many times, but it's still, you don't visualize it. Everybody loves to think about Jesus and his guy that's going to run around. Nobody likes to think about him as this little mewing baby, crying, dumping in his pants, wetting his diaper. I mean, that was God. And now it's God bound with shame so that he couldn't even move, so he couldn't even talk, so he couldn't even defend himself. Hey, this doesn't compute. Do you understand? So let's continue. And Pilate asked him, "Art thou the King of the Jews?" And he answered and said unto him, "Thou sayest it." And the chief priest accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? Behold, how many things they witness against thee." But Jesus answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. But why did he answer nothing?
He was ashamed.
He was shut up, bound up by shame, so that he was immobilized. You'll never hear this in Dallas Seminary. If he weren't, he couldn't have taken on my shame. Can you visualize this? The Son of God bound with shame so he cannot answer? Now, you have to deal with this one. You can't finesse it. The basis of shame, the thing that happens in shame, remember where we first start, the origin of it. It makes us fear that we are going to be rejected. And there's nothing that we can say or do. And the more foolish you are, the more you will have experienced shame. That's why God chose the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. Now,
so far, he qualifies of all the things I've heard you say. He has, as the Son of Man, that person has completely disappointed. He's failed. He's brought shame, complete shame upon his family.
Do you remember? You guys really, you understand it? I don't know if some of you haven't been here when I taught this, but do you understand that Jesus Christ failed after the flesh?
It sounds like this is what he realized.
He failed in the mission that he was sent to accomplish. And now here he's facing the shame of that failure. If this is either true or we're in deep trouble.
Failed on the mission he was sent to accomplish. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, let's go.
Did he know that we failed?
Then if you say that, then you trivialize his life. Have you ever had a revelation of God? You forget it about 3 minutes later?
Yeah, he lived it. Sit back and watch it.
Well, he also, he would... You know, that's what the purpose of him reading the scriptures, and the same reading the purpose of you reading the scriptures. That's why he celebrated the feast. That's why we celebrate the feast. There's this slow dawning awareness that there isn't two messiahs, as the Jews think. And the one that's going to be the fail and the other one's going to swim. There isn't this thing that Jesus Christ is going to come back and reign on earth for 1,000 years and all that. If he isn't here now, he never will be. Matthew 22. Matthew 21, I'm sorry. Here another parable.
We're on 121.
I'm not going to tell you. Here another parable.
What?
Ah, well, are you going to let the rest of the class know?
33.
Here another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard and hedged it round about and digged a wine press in it and built a tower and let it out to husbandmen and went into a far country. And when the time of the fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the husbandmen that they might receive the fruits of it. And the husbandmen took his servants and beat one and killed another and stoned another. Again, the husbandman is God here, obviously. And again, the owner, the householder is God. The husbandman, in this case, was a Jewish race. Or us. And again, he sent other servants more than the first, or greater than the first, and they did unto them likewise. But last of all, he sent unto them his son, saying, They will reverence my son. But when the farmers, or the husbandmen, saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and let us seize on his inheritance. And they caught him and cast him out of the vineyard and slew him. When the Lord therefore of the vineyard cometh, what will he do unto these husbandmen? And they said unto him, he will miserably destroy those wicked men, and will let out his vineyard unto other husbandmen, which shall render him the fruits in their seasons. And Jesus said unto him, did you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner? This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore say I unto you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you, and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. And whosoever shall fall on this stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. When the chief priests and Pharisees heard this parable, they perceived that he spoke of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitude, because they took him for a prophet. By the words of Christ, he failed in this.
But all the Old Testament says he's going to fail. I mean, he knew that. So he didn't fail.
As son of man.
I'm sorry. I see what you're saying. Okay.
I mean, you understand, if you just make him this, you know, like Superman kind of guy that runs around and does stuff, you trivialize him and you make him just another idol. You make him Chief Balaam, he's your chief god. And you'll never understand him. You'll never understand him in relationship to you. All right. Back to Mark 15.
So that'll fall into where he says, you believe in him, but you won't believe on him.
Yeah. Well, that's why until you go to the cross. When you go to the cross, you die. Therefore, you have to believe on him or you won't live. Man can believe in him for a short time. And they think he's going to come and do good things, but every man will be Judas, because he will deny, he will disappoint.
He will fail.
He will fail them by their understanding. And every man will betray him. That's why when we take the bread and the wine, we always say the same night in which he was betrayed, he took the bread, and he broke it, and he blessed it. I mean, that's why the sin offering is daily. He has to fail you by your mind. Otherwise, your mind will worship him. And your mind is illegal for it to worship him because it's flesh and blood. You can't get there from here.
I've heard you say that 100 million times.
All right. Jesus answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. You understand that in theology, in theology schools, they take a different tact with regard to his silence.
Put him above all of it.
They put him above it all, like he is. He's too strong in the faith to be concerned with what they're saying to him. If that's the truth, then I'm hopeless. I have no hope. Now at that feast, he released unto them one prisoner, whomsoever they desired. And this was the celebration of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, when they released the prisoner. That's the day he was going to be buried. There was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them, that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude, crying aloud, began to desire him to do as he had ever done unto them. But Pilate answered them, saying, will you that I release unto you the king of the Jews? For he knew that the chief priests had delivered him for envy. Right. But the chief priests moved the people that he should rather release Barabbas unto them. And Pilate answered and said again unto them, what will ye that I shall do unto him whom you call the king of the Jews? And they cried out again, crucify him. Now shame makes us fear that we will be rejected by people that we love. And here, everybody that he loved, whom he came to, rejected him and said, crucify him. You understand?
Well, it's such a pretty painting that I've saw for so many years. Christ just became so human. It's just never been that human.
One man. That's great. Now you can empathize with him on the cross, why he had to die. And then you can see why, what his resurrection is. And your warfare is over.
It's the contradiction of sinners.
As long as you believe there's something left to do, then you, by definition, and if you're a believer, you have to believe that he didn't do this. He didn't, which is a long, convoluted thing I don't feel like going into. Forgive me for saying it. They cried out again, crucify him.
That was funny.
It's the second time he's done that.
And Pilate said unto them, why? What evil hath he done? And they said out more exceedingly, crucify him. So Pilate, willing to content the people, released Barabbas unto them and delivered Jesus when he had scourged him to be crucified. Shame makes us fear we will be rejected by the people that we love. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I promise you within a couple months you will. Some of you have so hidden the shame that you have become a caricature of a human being. And the soldiers led him away unto the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole band, and they clothed him with purple, and plaited a crown of thorns, and put it about his head, and began to salute him, Hail, King of the Jews. Now, we are afraid that if we expose our shame, we'll be mocked. And here, he's being mocked. This isn't mocking in humor. This is mocking for the purposes of destruction. And they smote him on the head with a reed and did spit upon him, bowing their knees and worshipped him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple from him and put his own clothes on him and led him to crucify him. Now, we're afraid of being exposed, or we're afraid of being naked. Here he had to be exposed. I mean, they didn't have little underwear stuff in those days. He was exposed to the Praetorium, and he's going to be exposed again on the cross. He didn't have a little loincloth.
Like the paintings.
When you're crucified, remember, he start, and again, I say this because you have to get the imagery of its importance. When the Word took on flesh, its first experience of taking and this is the reason Satan fell, because he wouldn't worship this mewing, incontinent human being that was the baby. He wouldn't worship him. Neither will you, a son of man. You can only, you must be crucified in order for that you can see. And here, at his beginning, he was incontinent. At his end, the first thing that happens on the cross when you're crucified, when the weight of the body goes, as you become incontinent, and you release all the feces and the urine that's in your body, naked, before all. Now, you can't understand his resurrection unless you understand his crucifixion. You can't share in his glory unless you despise your shame. It must be exposed to be despised. And it must be made fun of. And at the end, the enemies will be they of your own household. They will make they must mock your shame, and yet you can laugh at it. And they compel one Simon of One Simon, a Cyrenian, who passed by coming out of the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Now, the reason they said Alexander and Rufus here is because Alexander and Rufus became major players in the first century church. I mean, they were like biggies, and it was their father who had carried his cross, which is pretty wild.
Yeah.
And if, you know, again, from legend, we know that the one that the Roman soldier, Longinus, as it was his name, was that stabbed Christ in the fifth chakra, if you're of a new age. He became most prominent in the first church. I mean, these people that we make caricatures of were flesh and blood human beings that... Anyway. And they bring him into the place Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of the skull, and that's why the crucifixion has to place you crucify the Son of God afresh at the place of the skull. This wasn't an accident. This was called Golgotha. And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh, but he received it not. When they had crucified him, they parted his garments, casting lots upon them what every man should take. And it was the third hour, and they crucified him. And the superscription of his accusation was written over the king of the Jews. And with him they crucified two thieves, one on his right hand and the other on his left. And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, and he was murdered. He was numbered with the transgressors. And they that passed by railed on, wagging their heads and saying, Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself and come down from the cross. Likewise, the chief priests mocking, said among themselves with the scribes, He saved others, he cannot save himself. Now we can take this great heroic view of Jesus Christ at this moment and say, well, he could have sent down 10,000 angels. He could have done all that, but he was immobilized. He was powerless. Why? He was powerless because he took on him the shame of the human race. He took on him your shame. And if you retain your shame, he died in vain. Shame makes us powerless, and he was powerless. It's hard to, can't believe that, can we? Biggest shame of all, the biggest fear of shame that strikes at the core of our being, that is universal to all men, is that shame makes us feel that we will be abandoned. We will be left alone. We will be abandoned. Let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross that we may see and believe. And they that were crucified with him reviled him. And when the sixth hour was come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And so shame makes us fear that we will be totally and completely abandoned. And here, he was totally and completely abandoned by God. His fear came true. His shame came true. His enemies used shame in an attempt to destroy him, and they succeeded. He was profoundly discredited. His mission plan was shown as a sham. His purpose in being was a joke. His followers scattered, every single one of them. He was a total failure. This one will be hard for you to understand, but shame had the last word, and shame defined him. he and his words were scorned and cursed. Now hear me very carefully. Since this moment in time, Satan's main emphasis has been to try to cause you to get to the resurrection while hiding the shame. Because you will be worthless on judgment day. You understand that?
That's what a lot of churches do.
Hiding the shame. You have, in fact, there's not even a forum for the shame.
Our whole society is shameless.
Our society is shame-based. Yeah. It's what you avoid is what it becomes. I mean, again, and it's the reason, it's in families, shame can be dealt with. In tribal families. You understand? I mean, because you stay together, your life is defined together, and you remember, and there's, you know, there's corrections and things that can come about. But the modern world and modern religion tries to get, first of all, Satan had to destroy that family structure. It had to destroy the sense of a tribe. He had to destroy the idea that Christianity and community were inseparable. And he had to cause the modern church to think it could get to the resurrection without dealing with shame. He succeeded. Now, can you see how shame is connected with the garment being spotted by the flesh? Can you see that's why laughter is the freedom from the garment being spotted from the flesh?
Mm-hmm. That's a sure sign that you haven't, you know, let go of shame over something, because it can come up and there may be laughter, but you, you know.
You internalize it. You take yourself seriously then. You have all these things. Well, we're just as guilty as the modern church. We desire to our detriment that the crucifixion has obliterated the shame. We desire that the resurrection, I should say, has obliterated the shame so that we don't have to deal with it. And so we become a people useless to God. Understand?
I understand, but I don't understand.
We're useless to God because there can never be an open test. We can never prophesy. We can never be totally open because there's always a component of us that we're hiding. That's why it's so evil to always dine alone. That's why a part of community, a part of resurrection, a part of knowing is breaking bread together. You know, that's why the single most important thing we've done as a people, other than the preaching of the cross, is starting Fox's Lair. Because it's a place where we break bread together. You probably don't even know we have common meals up here 3 times a day.
I didn't think I was invited.
You're probably not. No.
That's where we do all the secret stuff.
Our common central self-deception of all of us, of all of the people on the face of the earth, is that we are to be successful in isolation. Therefore, shame must be denied and hidden. We can never reveal our shame. We're taught from childhood not to reveal the shame. So there's no... You cannot, by definition, you can't be successful and be shame-based or have shame. You understand? I mean, so you have to hide it. And therefore, we are always, the society protects us from the need for being, from the need for trusting in anybody. And for the need of just having any kind of vulnerability. It's great to talk about vulnerability, right? There's all these pop art psychobabble books about vulnerability. And, but it's like it's this joke I told you that it's okay. There's a road up. There's a road. You're in the fork of the road. And one fork says vulnerability, and the other fork says discussion group about vulnerability. One fork says heaven, the other says discussion. I love that one. That's what the guy. You know, today you got. I haven't talked to you since.
Yeah, people don't like that.
Yeah, sure I have. I forgot. Well, yeah, because the thing that the shameless man needs no one. Shameless woman needs no one. I mean, it's so. The fact that our society is shame driven is the evidence that it's shame driven is that it denies shame. I mean, like, you know, like the cliches that we've talked about with regard to most industry now. I think probably the greatest percentage of the gross national product in the West is towards pleasure industries. Yet, none of them work because
it's just creating.
Well. Because I mean, the fact that none of them work is the fact of their success. It's like Dwayne Thomas's famous quote about when they were going to play in the Super Bowl, and he said,
"Yeah,
so if it's the ultimate game, why is it played again next year?"